This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Peter Smith. He's former assistant director of UNESCO. He's founding president of California State University at Monterey Bay and founding president of the Community College of Vermont. He served as lieutenant governor of Vermont and representative in the U.S. Congress. And he's author of several books, including The Quiet Crisis, How Higher Education is Failing America, and Harnessing America's Wasted Talent, A New Ecology of Learning. He's also newly president of the board of KSFR. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Glad to be here.
So let's talk about higher education today. I think it's very interesting, the history of higher education in the United States. Colleges and universities started with one kind of role and mission and have evolved quite a lot. College was not always thought of as a necessity for ordinary people or a prerequisite for success. What was their original role? How has that changed over the course of the last century?
Well, I've never been confused with a great historian of as being a great historian of higher education, but in simple terms, before the Land Grant Act in the in the 1860s and before the GI Bill, especially after World War II, the deeper history was for the elites. It was for training of clergy, and it was for simply like what we would have thought of in the 60s or 70s as a finishing school for men headed into either academic, law, or religion. What happened with Justin Morrill's passage in Lincoln's signing, I have to say Justin Morrill's, United States Senator from the great state of Vermont, was that for the first time it was the law of the land that in every state there would be property set aside and an institution designated that would actually serve the economic interests of the state and the agricultural interests of the state, as well as educating people who had not been educated before. No one quite knew what that meant in 1870, but there it was. And the real what really happened over the next 40 or 50, I'm going to say 70 to 100 years, 70 years, is that those institutions, as they began to develop, were great supporters of economic development, helping farmers with better science. What they thought at the time was better science may not be considered better science today in some cases. But the real change came as this infrastructure was built, and it's really comprised of two types of institutions, what are called flagship universities. University of New Mexico would be a flagship university, and then the land-grant colleges. Sometimes they are the same institution, sometimes they are not, but the land-grant colleges were more focused on careers, on economic development, etc. The real change, though, came after World War II when the GI Bill was passed. Again, for very economic and social reasons, all these guys mostly coming back. Women had been in the workplace there, and Truman foresaw a real train wreck. And I think they did some of the most enlightened thinking. There was a commission. I can't remember the name of the commission at this point. But it was in the late 1940s. And from it, the GI Bill and the community, what we now think of as the community college movement, which completely rewrote the vision or the underlying vision for what higher education should be about. Now, that represented, when I started the Community College of Vermont in 1970, 71, there was still a huge gap between the publicly funded state colleges and universities, let alone the private colleges like Middlebury in Vermont or Bennington. Well, I ended up on the board of Bennington, but that was a whole different sequence. But there was a huge gap between how they saw the function of higher education and the way we looked at it as a community-based activity that was for people who, through no fault of their own, had been left out of the opportunity equation and were living on a dirt road in rural Vermont. And so we started with 25 Head Start mothers and 8 years later, we had an accredited college that was part of the system. Our vision at that time, and the community college vision you see here at Santa Fe Community College with President Grissom and his team, is a fundamentally different vision than that which supports or is endorsed by the Ivy League or the top 300 prestige-wise institutions in the United States of America. They are still into the refining of the mind and great thinking, and very important things like great writing, great critical thinking, great problem solving, and those are important human as well as academic skills or abilities to have. But the purpose of broadening the middle class and giving opportunity to those who through no fault of their own have not had access to opportunity, and maybe often through the fault of others have been denied access to opportunity, that role for education is only in the last 20 years, I think, really emerged into the mainstream of the debate, to the point where some in the more elite side will say the vocationalization of higher education is now proceeding apace. And that's their way of looking down their noses at community colleges or more experimental colleges that are different from them. So that's where the debate now, the tension in the debate is right on the table for all to see, and then exacerbated now by the economics of higher education, which are brutally difficult.
Well, I mean, that's the thing that's sort of interesting about this. I mean, there doesn't have to be, and in my view, shouldn't be a divide between vocational training and critical thinking, because if you want to do any job well, critical thinking, analysis, and access to, for example, art and music, that helps with everything.
Absolutely.
Not only being values in themselves, but, I mean, one of the ways in which the system is in flux is that people who might 20, 30 years ago have gone to the Benningtons or the Ivy League colleges, there's a lot of people now, a lot of very bright young people saying, I'm not going to even choose those schools because I'm going to come out with a mountain of debt.
Right. It's what we have run into is a sort of the trifecta from hell. You have states' willingness to fund public higher education in all of its various forms dwindling. There are some outliers, but in general, the public funding is down. There's more funding going into scholarships. You have endowments which support other institutions which are having very uneven performances, and that leaves only one thing to give, and that's where you give is on tuition, and tuition goes up and up and up and up. So you've got this trifecta, none of which is working to preserve it, to preserve the institutional structures that we've taken for granted without accumulating an enormous amount of debt. And at the same time, the reason I called the subtitle of my second or third book, but the second one you mentioned, A New Ecology of Learning, is all of a sudden, if I can access the entire MIT undergraduate curriculum for free, could I build a college conceptually around that, where I'm saying, okay, MIT's content is sufficient. Now I'm going to put some other resources, high-quality resources, and I'm going to create group independent studies and stuff. I mean, there's myriad different ways to get in touch with great content, to access great art, to be asked to think critically and reflectively, to write, and to be assessed and appraised not through the value lens of a professor, but because of what you know and are able to do and what you can show that you have produced. So that at the same time you have this collision of that results in much higher costs and debt, you have all these new ways of doing business that are cost much less, and while they don't mirror what we all would have thought of as a quality undergraduate experience in terms of residential education, the very traditional mode, they don't look like that. But they are available to people in ways and at prices that people couldn't have imagined 25 years ago.
We're talking to Peter Smith. Now, it does bring up what you're talking about, brings up very interesting questions about the nature of education and about pedagogy, because, I mean, it's one thing to have the curriculum and the books, and those are very important, but what is learning? How much of that happens in conversation? How much of that is hands-on? How much of that happens when you form relationships with teachers and mentors? Mm-hmm. If somebody hands you the curriculum and you're living in your apartment in Santa Fe and taking MIT's curriculum, what are you getting? What are you missing?
Well, that goes to the model. Learning is a social activity. There's no doubt about it. And one of the main, not drawbacks, but features of online learning that people are now very seriously grappling with is that all by itself, it's not a great way to learn for a whole lot of people, because learning involves interaction, social interaction, with mentors and with peers. I think of assessment of learning as being these days the possibility that assessment, thinking about what you've learned and how you've changed as a result of your learning, what you know, what you can do, that should be part of the pedagogy as well. When you and I went to school back in the dark ages, well, I went to school back in the dark ages, not you. Assessment was a grade on a test at the end of a term, and it's a good job, B minus, or whatever it was. Now you can do much more, and I think of, for instance, reflection, the opportunities in social, in learning environments, managed learning environments, for people to reflect. And reflection is the process by which you separate or distinguish meaning from experience. So I took this course, or I read this book, or I did this physics problem, or I went, okay, so I did it. Now, what did that mean to me? What can I tickle out of that experience that I take away with me as being what I learned, and being clear about what I learned and what I know as a result of something, as opposed to the fact I just did it and did it okay and got a B minus and proceed. So social, you can't have good learning without social interaction. That has to be part of any design, regardless of the technology.
And one of the things that is so hard, and I think even back in your and my dark ages, we were learning in order to take tests, and they're certainly doing that today. And it is striking how much and how thoroughly you can forget what you've studied in order to do well on that test. And I think what you're talking about, or what I'm hearing, is the kind of learning that you retain and can build on.
Exactly. I got into this, I realized about 15 years ago, 10 years ago, that my career has been fueled by the fact that I simply fell in love with learning, not with teaching, not with schools, but with learning and changing people's lives through learning. And that happened because this is now done more regularly and routinely, but in the early 70s, it was considered very radical. You could take somebody who had done a job, been a Head Start teacher, whatever it might be, and might not have a degree, this is a long time ago, and you could assess their experience and extract from their work experience or their volunteer experience or their lived experience, you could extract actual academic credit equivalents and give people academic recognition for learning that they had done outside of school. Now, in the military, on the job, in the union hall, wherever. And what, by working through, this would be 45 years ago, what was important to know, how would you state it, how would you ask a learner to state it, who would evaluate it and find the credit or the equivalency for courses. But by working that all through, and there was about 20 institutions that did this in the early 70s, the Community College of Vermont being one of them, we developed standards for understanding learning that is derived from experience.
What are examples of that?
Oh, God. Well, For instance, I'll take a very simple one. I'm in the military, and I've served 3 terms, and I have, we all think of the military as bang, bang, and whatever. But in fact, the vast majority of people in the military do other things, logistics, supply chain management. They do all sorts of things, and they're trained to do them, and then they do them. But there's no way to equate that to an academic value. So what you would do today is bring all that back and then have it looked at for academic equivalence through a portfolio assessment or an equivalent exam or faculty review. But you would, or if I was a Head Start mother, to go back to our early days, and I'm getting some informal training, I'm learning how to take better care of my child. My child is in a child care, in a Head Start. I'm reading about parenting. I'm reading about human development. But there's no way for me to convert that to the beginning of an associate degree in early childhood development.
Right.
So you take all that and then build a portfolio and have experts look at the portfolio and say that's worth 6 credits.
I think one of the reasons this is interesting and important is because, I mean, you say, okay, there's a guy who comes out of the military and he's an expert in supply chain management. Well, why can't he get a job in distribution of food or shoes or whatever it is? But it turns out for a lot of those jobs, whether it makes any sense or not, you actually need a degree.
That's right. And that's changing. And it's going to be, how it changes, it's too early to say, but there are increasing number of major employers saying, unless there is a legal or a professional requirement for a degree, here's what we want somebody to be able to do on day one, be ready to work on day one. The whole critique they're levying on higher ed is, your students may be ready to graduate, but they're not ready to work. And the most expensive thing we do is retrain people for the first 6 to 10 months and lose people in many cases because they aren't ready to work. So now you begin to see major employers saying, here's what it is that someone needs to know and be able to do behaviorally and skill-wise, writing, reflection, whatever it is. And if you can show me, or an institution can show me, that a person can do that, can do those things without a certificate or a degree, we'll take them, and then they can earn their certificate and degree if they want it or need it later on. So that's changing, Mary Charlotte, and it's going to wreak havoc. In an information-rich society where more people know more about more things, whether they're accurate all the time or not is a different issue.
Yeah.
It's going to wreak havoc with job readiness and job preparation programs.
There's also some really interesting barriers that people have if they come from, there's a story in one of your books about a young man who was in the military and he somehow found himself in a cohort of people who came from really a higher level of social class and education than he had. And he was very bright and they basically brought him along and said, you're a bright guy, you know, hang out with us. And it rubbed off on him, but not as much as he needed in order to get to the next step and get to their level. And I thought that story was very poignant because it speaks to a kind of class stratification that we have in this country that really does a number on people emotionally and psychologically.
Absolutely. And when Al, you're talking about Al, when Al then went to community college first, and he describes, I've been a firefighter, I've been a policeman, and I walk in and I am literally shaking in my boots. I've faced death, everything's okay, but I walk in there and he says, I could have failed or I could have passed and it wouldn't have made any difference, but I'm literally shaking in my boots. I was terrified. That, I think, happily, the new kinds of opportunities, and if you look at the way Santa Fe Community College is responding to needs in the community, and I think they are emblematic of other community colleges and other colleges, those barriers are coming down precisely because we can blend learning with work. We can have someone know exactly why it is they're going into a program of higher ed, because there is a payoff that is discrete and tangible and there. And they may not have to get the degree in order to get the job. And as those barriers come down, the social barriers come down, I believe, as well. There's really interesting information. Texas, the University of Texas at Austin, They will take, if you're in the top 10% of your high school class, you are automatically admitted. They were still wonderful progressive policy. They were still losing, I'm going to say, a majority of those people who were of color and women, even though they were in the top 10%, because what they found is when one thing went wrong, it was binary. The person would then say, I'm not meant to be here.
Yeah.
I'm meant to be someplace else. So they created these leadership programs, not remediation, not like, you got a problem, we're going to fix you, but you're here, you're good, you're a leader. And now, and they created leadership programs for all entering freshmen, and now their retention rate is last time I looked, as good as any other freshman entering. So it has to do with how you treat people.
And it's so interesting. I mean, calling some, there have been studies about this with children. You take a child and say, you've got so much promise, and you could take another child of exactly the same ability and say, you're a problem kid, and then they will do that. You take a young person, you call them a leader, they become a leader.
Exactly. And one of the things that I think is very cool about this new higher education center that we have here in Santa Fe, where you have 5, 6, you know, IAIA, UNM, New Mexico State, all of them, and Santa Fe Community College, is that it begins to break down the notion of exclusivity. Here they all are in the same building, and the question is, what works for you? Not, oh, do I have to go to Albuquerque, or do I have to go to Las Vegas, or do I have to do this or that? But it begins to break down the sense of exclusiveness being the price of opportunity. And that should not be the price of opportunity. It should not be that you feel that you have to overcome feelings of inferiority to be present.
We're talking to Peter Smith, who is an expert in many different fields of higher education. He was a founding president of two different colleges. He was assistant director for education at UNESCO. He was in politics, including lieutenant governor of Vermont, and served as a representative in U.S. Congress, and has written a lot about higher education. And education is such an interesting and important topic that everybody talks about, and you can disagree on that as much as on religion, politics, or anything else. One of the problems that we have in this country that plays out in education is racial disparity and economic disparity. And of course, the racial disparity comes out of a historical process, including slavery and Jim Crow. And, you know, a lot of the black primary schools and secondary schools just aren't as good as the white schools on the other side of town. So what happens then? I mean, a kid graduates, which, you know, there are kids who graduate from some of these schools and they've never heard the word grammar. They don't know what it means. Mm-hmm. They don't know how to write a proper sentence. And then they're expected to go to college. What can secondary education do to make up for that? Or should that not be the role of secondary education?
Well, when you talk about the demographic and economic structure of society and how communities are formed, both politically in terms of their boundaries, but also the confluence of natural forces and economics, you have something that is so widely disparate within a state, let alone within the country, and then you have 20,000 local school boards on top of it. And the whole, it is, I'll be honest, one of the reasons I actually respect the superintendent of schools here in Santa Fe so much, apart from any particular thing he's doing, is that he holds up as the primary value principle that every kid is able to learn, and that the job of the school is not to screen, but to encourage and enable and help people be successful given their own naturally given talents, and to try to radiate that where it is not present into schools and with teachers and parents, to create an expectation that things, that if you work hard and play by the rules, that you're gonna be successful, because the school's gonna be there for you as opposed to a screening device. I was chairman of my local school board in a little rural town in Vermont, and one of the things that goes without saying about Vermont at the time, it was absolutely the whitest state in the country. So in fact, what we were able to do was focus on income and ethnicity that was not apparent facially or racially, and look at the unevenness and the disparity in the little town that we were in was seventh out of seven towns, and sending kids to the local high school, regional high school, and having them be successful. At the end of 10 years, we were first. Now, part of that is because people started to move to town because they heard that we had great public schools. But the other part of it was that in a small elementary school, and I would say this goes, size matters in this case, in the sense that having good teachers who stick around and having ratio of adults who stick around and are capable to kids that are favorable, like 1 to 15, 1 to 20, 1 to 22, and having the community directly involved in the school, not only from 9 to 5, but from 5 to 9 in the evening and on the weekends, that made a difference in the lives of kids from families whose older brothers and sisters had, in fact, dropped out of high school. And it was, we called it the Middlesex Design for Education, but what it really focused on was a commitment that every kid could learn, and we didn't have any more money than anybody else, but we pulled it off. When somebody is out to do bad to somebody else, sort of indirectly because of race or income, that becomes a political problem that I think this country still has a long ways to go on. And it is just a depressing fact. But I really value the public conversation about education in Santa Fe. I think it's honest. I think it's forthright. And people are engaged, and that's the only way you're going to get anything better going on in schools.
One of the things that you write about and that is key to every kid being successful, as opposed to, in your words, the school being a screening device to kind of take out the bad kids and let the good kids succeed and have the other kids fail. But in order to have something different, namely every single kid is able to learn, able to succeed, one of the things you really need is to understand that there are different kinds of learners and different
Absolutely.
Kinds of intelligence. Talk about this. What does that look like?
Well, you can make it really complicated, or you can, and there are academics, and the science is complicated. In other words, there are five or six or seven different learning styles. The key is, and to understand that, then what a good teacher will be able to do if they're working on it is to find out and help the learner figure out which is the learning style that is best for them. And it will become apparent quite quickly. Some people would rather work alone or one-on-one. Other people like to do hands-on stuff. Other people will want to stand up and show what they know. And the idea that if you have a classroom where there's only one way for you to behave and there's only one way for the teacher to behave, which I think is changing, but then you by definition are screening out all sorts of opportunity to find out the true strength of the individual learner. And that's where parenting also, if I were in a PTA and wanted to do one thing with parents, it would be to help them understand and give them the tools to understand how their kid interacts with information and data around them, how they interact with their lived experience. Because if parents know that, they can then help teachers understand it.
And one of the things that's so interesting is a lot of the times children are really different from their parents in the way they learn, and that can lead to a lot of conflict at home.
It's and I saw a lot of this when I was at Cal State Monterey Bay. We had a lot of first generation kids coming from the Salinas Valley, and their parents were pickers, and they'd been pickers, part-time pickers, at age 16, 17, 18. And they would go home on the weekends, and we actually would send people out in cars to pick them up and bring them back to school on Sunday night, because the pressure was so enormous in some cases. Stay here. This is a life we understand. We need you economically. We need you to pick. What the hell are you doing going to college? So there was a whole range of ways it was expressed. But we actually would send our counselors out to get people and bring them back to school.
Yeah.
But then you have to make room for them. So rather than initially teaching American history, you know, the way I learned it in Vermont, we would say, go back and interview your parents and your grandparents and ask them, starting in the Korean War, whenever it might be, and write down what they say and come back and report to us what their experience has been with the political or the cultural or the economic history that they have experienced living in the last 35, 40 years. And what it unlocked was, advisedly, this is not the American history that most people think should be taught at a college, but what it did was give us a platform on which we could then build the more formal study of history as it had happened in California, on the coast, in Monterey and Salinas. And we could get to all that other stuff, but it was through a lens that made sense to the individual learner.
And once you have, like in that example, people doing those interviews, then any other interviews that are even remotely similar become interesting and relatable.
Exactly. And they're, oh, by the way, writing. And we're not grading. I mean, we're helping them be better writers all the time. But the key here is to get kids or anybody to write because it's the best way to capture something and not worry about whether they got it absolutely right, but just to write.
Yeah.
And write. And the more you write, the better you get. One of the really interesting things that's happening now is something they call, Mary Charlotte, the flipped classroom. They're talking about parents having a different view of the world than kids. Homework. The whole notion of homework is that your parents are there and can help you do the work, when in fact that is increasingly not the case. And so the flipped classroom involves giving kids lessons to take home that they can do on their computer, they have to have a computer to do it. They basically, to put it in traditional terms, get the lecture. They get the lecture at home, and they write things down, and they practice at school. So the whole notion of a flipped classroom is, you take home the things that the content that your parents can't help you with, and then when you come back to school, you do your homework. You practice with your teacher and with other students. And it is having a markedly positive effect in situations where you have recent immigrants from all over the world who simply, or poor kids from America, can't get it at home.
Or girls who get to study women as well as men.
Amen.
Authors, for example, or whatever. I mean, if you were studying authors of people whose experiences relate to you. I don't know how many war books I read as a child in school, and they were so boring, but the guys loved them. And,
of course,
you know, I don't know that we read any women authors in most of my schooling. And so there's that. And then there's also this set of differences that you write about, and that comes from some studies that have been done on learning styles. So there are people who are linguistic learners and logistical mathematical learners and spatial learners and musical and interpersonal and naturalist and so on and so on. And those different styles, if a kid is allowed to use that and excel, I mean, every kid is expected to learn these other disciplines where they might not be able to express themselves as well. But they can be more successful. And I guess what this made me think of is the question of whether learning style correlates with the field that a person goes into later. Like, in some cases, it must. Like, a visual and spatial thinker might become an architect or an artist. A mathematical thinker might become a mathematician.
Exactly.
But, you know, an interpersonal learner could go into anything.
Well, and you're absolutely right. And one of the things that we do a not good job of, and there doesn't mean everybody does a bad job, but it's uneven at best, is helping a 16-year-old understand how their behavior, so it's learning style, but it's also their behavior, and I'll use myself as an example in a minute, might instruct which professions or fields they might be more successful in. Because to use a simplistic term, if I think I want to be a nurse, okay, but I throw up at the sight of blood, maybe that will determine what kind of nursing I go into, or the fact that I, if it's health, maybe I find something else I can do in the health professions that doesn't involve seeing blood. So Peter Smith would not be a good airline pilot. He would not be a good CPA.
He, you.
He, me.
Yeah.
That's right. This Peter Smith. I thought I wanted to be a diplomat, and I had somebody take me aside in college my sophomore year and put their arm around me and say, you know, Pedro, you're a great guy, but you're not a diplomat. And subsequent events have proven that to be an absolutely astute observation in terms of some of my legislative experiences and, you know, where I had to really work closely with other people and not being patient. That happened absolutely sort of, it was happenstance. Somebody cared enough about me to put their arm.
Right.
It doesn't happen systematically for anybody. And even most of the, there's a great book about Princeton recently where somebody was analyzing all the people graduate from Princeton and they've been groomed, the vast majority since they were in seventh grade, to be either on Wall Street or to be lawyers or to be doctors. And the whole thing is a refining process. It is not an educational and broadening process. It is a refining process. I don't think that's peculiar to any one institution, but I do think it is an endemic problem now. And it, you talk about parents, and including parents who did, one of the things that I had a superintendent tell me 7 years ago is the reason that the Common Core would fail, you know, those Common Core standards, is because parents didn't want their kids to get B's. And if you actually had an external common set of standards that were being compared, not everyone was going to get A's. And at the closer we got to it, when I went to school, if I got in trouble, it was my fault in general. My parents would support the teacher. The data is entirely reversed now.
Yeah.
And so parents have to rethink what it means for kids to actually learn a lot as opposed to get a good grade.
Well, let's say that we were to have a situation in which every teacher understood and every school understood kids' different learning styles, and every kid was supported in doing well, and every kid legitimately got A's because they were being supported in that way. What does that mean for the whole system?
The fact of the matter is, if you do what I call evidence-based assessments, so it isn't me making a value judgment about how much you know, but it is you being able to show me what you know, the whole notion of the bell curve, the idea that for every A there has to be a D, goes out the window. And that, to me, if you used evidence-based assessments, it's much better for the teacher. But the problem we have, and sometimes it is deserved and many times it's not, the problem we have is putting teachers in control of what goes on in classrooms. And you cannot improve any process when the person who is responsible for the process on a daily basis is disenfranchised or disempowered from being able to do what they think is right. It's just the law of human relations. Now, it doesn't mean that all teachers are great. What it does mean that, and there is some emerging research, that when superintendents and principals find ways to empower teachers to actually get invested in their kids, in kids' learning, and being rewarded for kids really learning using evidence-based assessments, things can get better.
One of the things that I wonder about, and I look at the European system because my mother is from Germany and they do things quite differently there. I mean, there seems in the United States to be this belief, and this belief that has evolved a lot over the last 100 years, that everybody needs a college education. Well, there are some people who are absolutely brilliant people who are, for example, carpenters, builders, mechanics. They don't need to be writing academic papers, and they shouldn't be writing academic papers, but they need a top-notch education. And I remember I used to live in Boston, and I had a car that always needed fixing because it was an old car, and I would only use European mechanics because they were trained at the very best institutions, the best trade institutions. And we sort of seem to have the worst of both worlds in that way. We don't have that kind of top-notch trade education. It's maybe looked down on in some sense. And also, we're expecting people who should get that to be doing work that they're not suited for.
Well, it goes to one of the basic conundrums in historic American education. When I was in high school, there were divisions, and then there was the vocational track, and the vocational track is invariably where you found poorer and maybe to some extent less capable students in terms of being able to demonstrate the capacity. And that's one of the reasons that most of the vocational centers were put sort of modified and in many cases put to bed, put in mothballs in the 70s, the 60s and 70s. I think if you look at the article in the New Mexican recently about the cooperation between Santa Fe Community College and this new school that's going to open, I guess, in next fall, where kids can be earning college credit and learning an occupation at the same time and graduate with both from high school. That is, I think, goes directly to your point, because what you don't want to bring forward, it's one thing to separate learning to be really good at something, auto mechanic, you name it, but also saddling that with the idea that that person can't or shouldn't have the right to appreciate the arts or write well or be an informed voter or enjoy the finer things in life. But that was a distinction that was made, that if the higher you were in divisions in high school, the more opportunities you had when you left high school. And somehow we've got to bring back the commitment, and I think the Santa Fe School District and this thing with Santa Fe Community College, you're seeing these alternative pathways to degrees and to work where one does not preclude the other, and at the same time, a pathway towards a job with a degree as a part of it doesn't assume that you don't have the right or the God-given ability to enjoy the finer things of life that used to be reserved only for people who went to college. So that's a barrier we're trying to figure out how to break down, I think.
We have an interesting situation in the United States right now that has a lot to do with the kind of income inequality that has increased so drastically in the last generation or two. And that is, on the one hand, there are not enough people being educated for the upper-level jobs in today's workforce. On the other hand, over a quarter of the workforce is making the minimum wage or close to it, under $11 an hour. And these jobs are a reality. Most of them are repetitive and boring and don't even require the kinds of skills that we're talking about people needing, like creativity and analytical thinking and good writing and so on and so on. What do you do with that as an educator?
Well, my retreat, the position I retreat to, and I don't mean that in terms of it's like going to higher ground. We know that there's a direct relationship between the more education you have, the longevity, the longer you live, the more you make, the more you vote, and the more you're involved in your community. And I'm working on co-editing a book for Columbia Teachers College Press right now, Return on Investment in Higher Education. Don't confuse me with an economist, but happily the guy who's my co-editor is an economist. So we're going to take care of that part with Scott. But what you've got to figure out is not confusing the fact that the more education you have in general is better for you and better for the community around you. But then to get inside that question and say, what is the more for you that will work, so that we don't have just one path that is, and we say you're either on that path or you're off the path, as opposed to saying there are multiple ways. And for instance, should the price of admission to college, price in quotes, be that you sign up for a degree program? I believe that one of the reasons community colleges and state colleges have higher dropout rates is that the way we've structured financial aid, you've got to sign up for a degree or certificate program. That may not be what the person needs. They need to take four courses to do X. So they sign up, they get financial aid, they take their four courses, they get what they came for, they leave, and they're recorded as a dropout.
Right.
And so we don't know how to make those kinds of differentiations in the data we collect. And so it all looks like failure when some of it may very well be failure, but some of it may be, I got what I came for. And the real question should be, what is it you want from college now? How can we help you get that? And how will you know when you get to that point where you've had enough for now? And can you go away without penalty and then come back later on? There's absolutely no reason why we couldn't organize the system that way. If we chose to.
There's an interesting moment that is coming up soon, which is that there have been quite a lot of indicators that many of the worst jobs in society are going to be replaced by robots. But it's a lot of people losing their jobs, and it's a lot of low-wage people losing their jobs. And that is both an possible disaster and a great opportunity for the United States to design a new workforce in which people are put to work doing things that are actually productive for society when these jobs go away. But I have no idea what that's going to look like. Is this something that you've looked at?
Well,
at all?
It's something, you know, when we get done with this book we're doing for Columbia, I'll show it to you, and maybe we come back and because I only know enough to be dangerous right now.
A little knowledge is a dangerous
that's
thing.
Right. But I would but I would tell you that I think this goes to more our politics. But when you spend the amount of money we spend in society incarcerating people, taking away their cars, impoverishing them and costing them their jobs for victimless crimes, on the one hand, you look at the price of that, the cost of that, as opposed to where some of that money could go if we hadn't taken away their job, their car, and their livelihood and made them poor, as well as paying $40,000 a year to keep them in a cell. Or you look at the collapse of the income structure, which I connect to the ability, and I'm not the economist here, of very wealthy people to make a lot more money, and it doesn't trickle down. It goes away and stays away. And to me, those are two things we have to think about no matter what. In other words, regardless of what gets robotized and what doesn't, people have to believe in it. And the Arab Spring, you know, was fueled, we now know, by social media, where people in Tunisia, when this guy burned himself up, other people said, I felt the same way. That's happened to me. Boom. And that's what's happening now with Black Lives Matter in this country. Things that people suspected or knew from their own personal experience are now being known generally across the society. And income inequality is another aspect of that. Too many people are going to know too much for nothing to happen. Something's got to give on this front.
Peter Smith is former assistant director for education at UNESCO. He's founding president of California State University at Monterey Bay and the Community College of Vermont. He was lieutenant governor of Vermont. He was representative to the U.S. Congress. He's the author of several books, and he is the president of the board of KSFR. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, it was my pleasure, and thanks for being patient enough to have me.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.